The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to the Tuesday Evening Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning us in tonight. Great show planned for you with Dr. Bob Zubrin, who is back with us. One quick note, I'm going to run it as if we may be doing the 60-minute show, although we will probably be able to do 90 minutes. So I'm going to shorten my front-end announcements, and I'm going to shorten the sponsor messages just in case. But Bob is with us. Let me just give out the essentials so that we can start in talking with Bob. The toll-free number for those of you who would like to call and talk with him is 1-866-687-7223. So have patience. Remember, we don't have any call screeners. If the line is busy a lot and you're trying to get in, remember, I only have one toll-free line. So email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com and tell me you're waiting for the line to clear, and I'll do my best to expedite the call to take in more callers. Email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can comment or post on our blog, which is our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right for upcoming shows. This is the first show listed. Open that archive page up. And then all the way down at the bottom is where you post comments and ask questions on the blog. And if you do that during the live show, I will get your message real quickly and be able to integrate it into the program. The toll-free number is our preferred way of communicating, so please use it if you can. 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You're totally able to download our shows and share them. Please do. The simple rules are, don't do anything commercial. Don't edit the programs, put them up on YouTube or anything like that, and written transcripts aren't permitted without prior approval. Email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com if you have any questions or special needs, and check out our full copyright statement at the bottom of every website page, as well as onegiantleapfoundation.org's website page. Check out the upper left menu, especially Listen Live and the support menu. And then also remember, we're a listener-driven and funded show, so your contributions keep us on the air and allow us to have great guests like Bob on the program. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit with onegiantleapfoundation.org. And your support really is crucial, and you still get a tax deduction for your gifts, both in California if you're a California taxpayer, as well as the feds through the 501c3. Our parent is onegiantleapfoundation.org. If you have any questions, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. If you like our programming and our shows, support us, and we deeply, deeply, deeply appreciate that. We do have sponsors, and you see their banner ads running across the page. I just want to thank our sponsors tonight. I'm not going to read their messages in case we do have the shorter program. So we appreciate the State Space Development Network with us regarding space settlement, the Space Foundation with their symposium coming up in April, Orbital ATK, AIAA, the American, Celestis, and also the Integrated Space Plan. And we certainly appreciate all of our sponsors. As I said earlier, Dr. Bob Zubrin is back with us, and he is an extremely well-noted author, global, international, famous, incredibly inspiring author, speaker, founder of the Mars Society, which is an international organization dedicated to furthering the exploration and settlement of Mars by the public and private means. You should watch some of his YouTube talks on the internet. You know, there's nothing like looking at and listening to a Bob Zubrin talk to be inspired, no matter what your mood is, no matter what you're doing. His work from Abu Dhabi when he did that last year, unbelievable. So you can read about Bob on our webpage. His full bio is there. You can just Google his name and find more information out about him than you ever thought possible and spend some time with it. But we have Bob for a limited amount of time, so I want to talk to him. Bob, welcome back to the show. How are you? And thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm fine, and it's a good time for space.
It is. So let's start out. The impact of Falcon Heavy. What do you think that really means for not just private space, but for public space, for going forward to the moon, to Mars, to finally getting a space program that we all want?
Okay, this is the shot heard around the world. This is Sputnik. This is a revolution. I mean, to understand what a big deal this is, let us recall that in 2009, President Obama pulled together a blue ribbon commission to see if it was possible to pursue George Bush's program to return to the moon. This was headed by Norm Augustine, the CEO of Lockheed Martin. And they came to the conclusion that it was not fiscally possible because it needed a heavy lift vehicle. And according to them, developing a heavy lift vehicle would take 12 years and cost $36 billion. Okay, now, here's SpaceX just did it on their own dime in 6 years, in half the time, and less than $1 billion the cost, less than a 30th of the cost that the Augustine Commission had reported. And the thing is three-quarters reusable. So, you know, this is astonishing. And it changes the game completely. We are now in a position where we can return to the moon very quickly if we adopt the correct approach. In other words, we could be back on the moon in 4 years and on Mars in 8. We need to have a purpose-driven space program in order to grab hold of this opportunity, but the opportunity is there. And furthermore, this is even bigger than that because, see, what Musk has done here is not just shown that he can do X, Y, and Z. He has shown that a private space company can do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, until SpaceX, there were all these people going around saying that they were starting their own launch company, that they were going to break through to orbit, establish, you know, access to orbit, and it was all, that none of it went anywhere. And now it has become real. And people are noting this, and they're saying, if he can do it, why can't I do it? Because there's other people in the world with money than Musk, and there are people in the world with a lot more money than Elon Musk. And so I think that, you know, he already has some competition here. He's got Blue Origin, the Strato launch, Virgin Galactic, but I think we're going to see a Russian SpaceX, we're going to see a Chinese SpaceX, we're going to see, you know, an Indian SpaceX. You know, 5 years from now, there'll be 6 or 7 companies like this competing with each other and driving the cost of launch down.
Do you think that NASA and the more or less traditional aerospace industry has absorbed this impact and knows what you're talking about?
Well, I think that there's probably a significant amount of alarm at Lockheed Martin right now and Boeing. I don't know. I mean, look, NASA right now, there isn't a NASA administrator. There isn't a NASA deputy administrator. There isn't a NASA chief of staff. NASA has been decapitated. There are various divisions in NASA that are functioning on their own, you know, the robotic exploration program, the space astronomy program. But the organization as a whole has no direction. But that could actually be productive because it may be that now somebody comes in, they're going to be, the organization will be open to maximum impact. But, you know, if they're not, if they haven't taken note of this, they're brain dead.
Well, they may be brain dead. I don't know. But I think they all say the words that are the appropriate words to say, but that doesn't necessarily represent what they really think. You mentioned, you know, that they're without an associate administrator or the real administrator. Do you see that as a detriment if that condition continues for a while? Does NASA really need a NASA administrator?
Yeah, it does. And it needs a leader, not just an administrator, which is something a bit more than an administrator. Look, I wrote an article that was published in National Review about a week ago. It was entitled "A Purpose-Driven Space Program?" Question mark. And it really brought up the difference between the functional parts of NASA, which at this point include robotic planetary exploration program and the space astronomy program. There are people, there's complaints you can make, but these people have clear objectives. They know what they want to do, and they're doing them, okay? Whereas the manned spaceflight program is proceeding without a purpose right now. It's proceeding without an objective. You know, they're saying, oh, we've got an idea. Let's build a space station in orbit around the moon. Well, what for? There's no reason to have a space station in orbit around the moon. You do not need a space station in orbit around the moon to go to the moon. It doesn't assist you in going to the moon. You do not need a space station in orbit around the moon to go to Mars or to asteroids. You don't need it for any purpose whatsoever. It's just something to do. Just like the fetish before this was the asteroid retrieval mission, where all of a sudden somebody came up with an idea that putting a 500-ton boulder in orbit around the moon was mission critical for sending humans to Mars. Well, obviously it wasn't. No such idea had ever figured into anyone's Mars mission plans before. It was just something they figured they could do because they wanted to do something with electric propulsion and they wanted to have some place to visit with the Orion. But it wasn't like there was any purpose to it. And, you know, there's a significant faction in the Trump administration that wants to return to the moon. Well, in that case, they need to start designing a plan to return to the moon. You don't get to the moon by not going to the moon. Okay? You get to the moon by going to the moon. I'm going to be publishing, or Space News is going to be publishing an article by me in its March 26th issue, which is going to outline a plan for how we can return to the moon very quickly, making use of the Falcon Heavy.
You already have a caller. Are you up for a caller this early in the show?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall out in Oklahoma.
Okay.
And basically, your opinion of the Falcon Heavy launch, I totally agree with you. It is a total paradigm shift in space technology. And that brings me to what Elon Musk is talking about is going to Mars. But I sat down and started trying to critically think what is missing before you can even think about going to Mars. And I came up with three items, and I kind of want to get your opinion on the three items and see if you've got one or two extras. The first one is we need to test and prove out artificial gravity. The second one is we got to start growing our own food in space because it costs over $4,000 a day to feed an astronaut. And three, we have to get a better handle on the radiation problem. What have I missed?
Let me just comment on what you have come up with. Okay, I happen to agree with you on artificial gravity as being the way to go to Mars. It's not that you can't go to Mars without artificial gravity, but you'd be deconditioning the crew if you did. And if we're going to explore, and exploring Mars is hiking around in a big, bulky, heavy spacesuit, the effectiveness of the crew will be significantly impaired if they are deconditioned. And it's just like you wouldn't prepare a commando team for a combat mission by putting them in bed rest for 6 months before they get it.
Exactly.
You don't want to go to Mars in zero gravity. Now, this is not, you know, we're not talking about developing warp drive here. This is not a fundamental technological breakthrough, but it's engineering that needs to be done, and I'm with you on that. The second thing you brought up was radiation.
Radiation is fine, Bob. He also brought up food.
Yeah, we'll get to that one, too. Okay. The radiation dose has been, the radiation danger has been overplayed by both radiation health effects researchers who want to make their own field more important and by, frankly, NASA bureaucrats who are looking for an excuse not to go to Mars, kind of like a 10-year-old wanting a snow day. You know, oh, there's 5 inches of snow on the ground. We can't possibly go to school today. Emphasizing the dangers that that would pose to children. The radiation danger going to Mars and back with present-day propulsion would represent about a 1% risk of cancer to each member of the crew, which is, frankly, a modest portion of total mission risk. Now, as far as growing food is concerned, if you work the numbers, this is what it is. If you want to have a Mars base, or certainly a Mars settlement, you want to grow food on Mars, okay? Because if you're there permanently, then the mass benefits of growing your food, and even though you have to bring various equipment to establish greenhouses there and so forth, the food you grow in a few years is much more provides much more useful mass than the mass you had to bring. Okay, but if you're just going on the first mission to Mars, you can bring your food, and it is less massive than bringing the greenhouse gear, and also. Food doesn't grow by itself. There's a lot of work involved in growing food, and you want to relieve the first mission or two of that work by just letting them bring their food. Now, if you recycle the water, which is most of the mass of the food, in other words, for instance, if you consider foods like, say, spaghetti, where you make a just gigantic pot of spaghetti from this, you know, 1 pound package, because most of it is really water. So if you're recycling the water, the food doesn't weigh that much. It's about a kilogram a day, which, at current launch cost, yes, it's like $4,000 a day, as you say. But still in all, it's not that much of the total mission mass. And frankly, the way to save that $4,000 is by reducing the cost of launch.
The Falcon 9 Heavy delivering food to the International Space Station would be a big cut in cost, but I don't know if that'll ever happen.
I don't know about the International Space Station. I see your point. But the Falcon 9 Heavy will lift the food because it's going to lift the mission that's needed to go to Mars. It'll lift everything until they have something better.
My other thought was that using the Falcon technology, we could build a new space station at less than $1 billion that would be twice as big as International Space Station, and we could put it in a logical place, which is equatorial low Earth orbit. And basically do the testing of artificial gravity and grow some food and also take another view of radiation at the same time.
Well, with a Falcon Heavy, you could launch a modest-sized space station in one launch. You'd launch it in an afternoon. It doesn't have to be a three-decade project.
Yeah. And it's less than the cost of maintenance of the International Space Station.
Yeah. Well, the purpose of the International Space Station was to cost money.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, it's time for let somebody else talk. Nice talking to you again.
Thank you, Marshall. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, listener, the line is available, 1-866-687-7223. You picked up an email from Dr. Doug in Southern California, who says, How do you suggest that the Falcon Heavy be used to go to the moon? It's only half as capable to LEO as a Saturn V, and it doesn't have an efficient cryogenic upper stage.
Okay. That's a good question, and I'm going to answer it in some detail in my article in Space News. I have an architecture. I call it Moon Direct. And here's how it goes. If you can launch 60 tons to LEO, you can land about 12 tons on the moon. Okay? And the first thing that I would do, so I would have a basic cargo lander that can land 12 tons on the moon. And so I would send a habitation module to the moon with no one in it, but land it there. And I would put the base near the pole, probably the South Pole, where there is permanently lit areas not far from permanently shadowed craters that contain water ice. Okay, so obviously you put the base in the lit areas where there's power, but you have close access to a crater. And then I would send a cargo module.
If you'd like to make...
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. That was a toll-free line. Go ahead.
All right. And then so I send a HAB module, and I send a cargo module loaded with goodies such as solar panels, vehicles, and a... moderate range power beaming setup, and I'll talk about that in a minute, and a high data rate comm setup, that would be landed right near the habitation module, and we'll have some telerovers on there that can take the solar panels out, set them up, and plug them into the HAB, so we've got a house with power, set up the comm system, get everything ready. Now for the people. Okay. The Falcon Heavy is not man-rated and must does not plan to make it man-rated. So we're going to lift another cargo module, and it has on it a vehicle that I call the Lunar Excursion Vehicle, the LEV. Okay. And this thing will be delivered to the surface of the moon on the cargo module. And what the LEV is, it is... it contains a cabin comparable to the cabin on the LEM, the Apollo Lunar Excursion Module. That weighed, that had a mass of 2 tons, and a hydrogen oxygen stage, which will be fully fueled until we have ISRU going on the moon, that can take it all the way from the surface of the moon to LEO. Okay, now that is a delta V of 6 kilometers a second. But if you use hydrogen-oxygen propulsion to do a delta-V of 6 kilometers a second, requires a mass ratio of 3.7, which means that the 2-ton thing, it'll be 8 tons that you have to deliver to the moon to send that back to LEO. And we can deliver 12 tons to the moon. So we have the mass to do it. This is a new idea, okay, that is... The crew on the moon is not going to rendezvous with a return capsule in lunar orbit like they did in Apollo, nor are we going to try to take a capsule to the surface of the moon and shoot it all the way back to Earth, because that would require a lot of mass because the reentry capsule is heavy. But the LEM cabin was very light. And so we're going to go directly from the surface of the moon to do a propulsive capture in low Earth orbit. Okay, that's what the return mission is going to look like. But this thing is being lifted to orbit by Falcon Heavy. There's no one in it. Okay. Once that's on orbit, we just send a crew up in a Dragon on a Falcon 9. They do a rendezvous with the LEV. The crew transfers from the Dragon to the LEV. They fly to the moon in the LEV, leaving the Dragon behind in low Earth orbit. There's no reason to take a heavy reentry capsule all the way to lunar orbit or the surface of the moon. We're just going to go to the surface of the moon in a lightweight cabin. What they go there, they land at the base, they exit the LEV, and then they can go and live in the HAB module. Now, I will point out, now, once they're on the surface of the moon, the key operation is going to be to set up the system for extracting water from the crater. Now, in order to do that, we're going to need to use power beaming, because there's no solar power available in the crater, and unless we have nuclear power systems, which are not likely to be immediately available, we have to get power into the crater, and you can either try to run cables which would be very heavy and very difficult, or we can beam it. Now, you know, people have talked about power beaming for geosynchronous warp 36,000 kilometers above the surface of the Earth down to the surface of the Earth. That's hard. Beaming power 36 kilometers from the edge of a crater into the crater is 1,000 times easier, okay? In the size of the dish you need is 1,000th the diameter. And, in fact, people have beamed power over distances of this length since the 1960s. And on the moon, we'd even be easier because you could use a millimeter wave radio, which is you can't use for long-distance transmission on Earth because it gets absorbed by water vapor. But we could use it on the moon because there is no atmosphere. And we could transmit power from the edge of the crater into the crater and use that to extract water. Okay, and then the water is taken back to the base and where it's electrolyzed and it's turned to cryogenic propellant. But I should emphasize that on this first mission and on the first several missions, we're going to the moon with all the propellant we need to come home. But now here's the thing, though, you need to understand. The LEV has a total delta V capability of 6 kilometers a second in order to be able to go from the surface of the moon to LEO. 6 kilometers a second, it takes 1.5 kilometers a second to go from the surface of the moon to the other side of the moon, another 1.5 kilometers a second to land, and another 1.5 kilometers a second to take off, and another one to land again. In other words, you have a vehicle that can do 6 kilometers a second, and if you are making propellant on the moon, that means you could use that vehicle to fly from the lunar base to anywhere else on the moon, land, explore that location, and fly back and land. So the LEV, the very same vehicle that we can use to return from the moon, can also be used to give us global access to every part of the moon. Okay, once we have local propellant production underway. Until then, it's just used to come back from the moon. Now, so they're on the moon for, you know, a couple of months, whatever. And then once they have this operation reduced to practice, of extracting water from the crater, trailering it back to the base, electrolyzing it, that can be continued by telerobots after they leave. So we can be accumulating propellant at the base. The propellant can be stored in the landing tank, in the propellant tanks of the landers, the cargo landers. So then they go back. So each mission after the first requires one Falcon Heavy launch and one Falcon 9 launch. So $100 million for a Falcon Heavy launch, $60 million for a Falcon 9 launch. There you go. They go back from the surface of the moon to Earth orbit, where they are met by a dragon, either the first dragon that launched them or by the dragon that was used to lift the crew that is going out after them, okay, which would probably be more usually the case because that one will be just about, you won't have spent much time in space at all. So there you have it. That's the architecture. And it's a new space architecture. It requires Falcon Heavy, Falcon 9, Dragon, cargo lander. It's a common cargo lander for both crewed missions and cargo, and the LEV. That's the complete system. So instead of spending money building a totally useless deep space gateway orbiting station, okay, we spend it to develop the LEV and the cargo lander. And you've got yourself a lunar base.
And your space news details this at the end of April?
March 26th.
Okay. All right. You have a caller waiting on hold for you. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Gabriel in Victoria, Australia.
Hi. Thanks for calling us. How are things down under, as they say?
Oh, well, they're great. I live right on the beach, so it's a perfect day.
Lucky you. Go for it with Dr. Zubrin.
Right. Maybe I can just bring us to Mars briefly. So I've just read again this paper, and I had a chat with an email exchange with David about this, the chains of magnetite crystals in the meteorite ALH84001, evidence of biological origin. 2000, Friedman et al. I've read through this paper again, and it really is very convincing, very impressive, and some of the associated papers. And I mean, I guess the question to Dr. Zubrin is, I'm baffled to some degree that David can have someone on from NASA who spends his life studying. He's a Mars expert. He works with Curiosity, and and he's asked about ALH84001 and if there is astrobiological significance to this, and others from NASA as well that I've heard speak about this, and you know, this evidence that I'm just reading here is not even mentioned. And the question is, you know, what is the astrobiological significance of ALH84001? And somebody who is a NASA Mars expert does not even mention this critical, at least it seems to me, line of evidence. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, Dr. Zubrin, why is there this disconnect? But have you got any impression?
Yeah, sure. I don't know about this particular individual that you're referring to and why he or she did not reference it, but I actually find some of the evidence brought up by the Alan Hill's people to be strong. And I think that it should not be ignored. And but you have to understand that most people are afraid to take viewpoints that are different from those of the tribe that they belong to. And it has become the accepted view of the tribe that of the astrobiologists or that the Alan Hills doesn't count. And so if you bring that up, it's like the skunk at the picnic, or the heretic in the church. And so,
yeah, that's right. That's what it's like.
So therefore, it's better for your career not to be associated with it. There are people that have legitimate disagreements with it that think that it is not strong, but I think that most of those who have not critically examined this, the reason why they avoid it is because it would be a heretical opinion that would make other people view them unfavorably. Other people.
Yeah, right. I've noticed that, and I think it's unfortunate. And, I mean, we don't want to get too sidetracked with technicalities, but, I mean, of these five characteristics of these magnetite chains, and, you know, the evidence for it is very good. And I mean, what is their main reason? And do they have a main scientific thrust for dismissing the characteristics of the magnetite chain?
I don't think they have a legitimate reason. You know, when the magnetite was first brought up by the Alan Hill people in 1996, it was not in chains, or they didn't show it as being in chains. And the William Schock, the rebuttalist that was brought to their press conference, said, "Show it to me in chains, so then I'll believe you that this is biogenic." And a few years later, Imre Friedman produced a paper where he showed that there were chains of it.
Right.
And there you have it. So that one did answer the mail, and they chose to shrug it off. And kind of like people saying that there's not a shred of evidence that Trump colluded with the Russians, despite the fact that his campaign was staffed with Kremlin operatives and supported by Kremlin black operations, and I could go on. It's just like, I don't want to see that. I'm just not interested in hearing about it. It's just one of those things that just doesn't fit in with the in crowd.
Right. And maybe I'll ask one more question about the broader astrobiological perspective on Mars. And this is perhaps a bit of a speculative question, but What do you think the odds are, as an expert, that Mars produced macroscopic organisms during its period of habitability? I mean, David has a gentleman, a scientist, who comes on sometimes, and it's his belief that Mars not only produced, you know, macroscopic organisms, but even potentially intelligent life. But, I mean, what is your view of the odds that during its period of habitability, Mars produced macroscopic produced a functioning biosphere that is that we could recognize here on Earth?
Okay. Well, first of all, yeah, let me answer this in part. I view it as essentially a certainty that there was at least once microbial life on Mars,
right,
from no other source than the Earth, because there was life on Earth, and in particular, by the way, in Australia,
yes,
where the stromatolites are, but I assume it was everywhere, because bacteria get around. But, you know, fossils of bacterial colonies from 3.5 billion years ago have been found in Australia.
Mm. And, I've heard all about it,
yeah, it's called a stromatolite. And there was liquid water on the surface of Mars at that time, and there was active transfer of material between Earth and Mars at that time due to lots of meteorite impacts going on. And so either life from Earth came from Mars or life on Mars came from Earth, but there would have been transfer. Now, there's it'd be very interesting to go to Mars if we could find life on Mars or in Mars. I think if there's life on Mars today, it's not on the surface. It's in groundwater underground. That's the habitable environment, not the surface. And the interesting question would be, which planet has the more primitive representatives? In other words, we know, for example, that if human beings went extinct and an archaeologist from an alien species came to Earth, they would know, despite the fact that there's all these artifacts of Western civilization in North America and Australia, that it did not originate on our continent, but in Europe, because you cannot find things more primitive in Australia than, you know, the colonial period, or in America than the late Renaissance. And in Europe, you can find the medieval age, the classical age, the Bronze Age, and so on. And could find our evolutionary cultural history there. Similarly, you know, it's a mystery that life on Earth, there's nothing, no free living organisms here simpler than bacteria, broadly put. And with a complete alphabet of DNA and RNA and all of that. And that's pretty complicated. So is life on Earth actually indigenous to Earth, or are we an immigrant species, an immigrant phenomena? And if we could go to Mars and find pre-bacterial organisms, things that were simpler, that showed the path from chemistry to life, then you'd say, well, life on Earth came from Mars. If you found a totally different chemistry that didn't use DNA and RNA, then you would say, well, it's probably life on Earth is indigenous, because what we have on Mars is totally different, and it looks like we have two separate origins. And if you found something very similar to Earth life but nothing more primitive, then I would suspect that life on Earth and Mars both came from outside the solar system.
Mm. Right. All right. Well, I'll let someone else call in. I'll just close by saying, with regards to food, there was a discussion earlier. You know, it really doesn't have to be. I mean, we have the technology to make this process really quite easy. Even on Mars. And and, you know, this is what my company develops, a horticultural technology. And, you know, it could be easily scaled to Mars. So, you know, it doesn't have to be difficult. And I think we could have, you know, colonists growing at least a portion of their food right from the start. So, anyway, that's what I'll finish on.
Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it.
All right. Yep. Bye.
Okay. listeners, that opens up our line for others who might want to call 1-866-687-7223. If you are in an area where you can't call toll-free, email me and I'll give you the direct line number, which is what I did with that gentleman who just called. My God, Bob, the phone's ringing again. I'm not going to have to work on this show. This is going to be pushing buttons for you. I do have an email that I'll read to you first from David, another David. He says, can you address challenges to SpaceX landing a Red Dragon or BFS on Mars using retro propulsion? I think they canceled that Red Dragon project, too.
Yeah, well, the Red Dragon, at least my knowledge and what they're saying publicly, has been set aside. In terms of retro propulsion, I think they've demonstrated that they can do it. The ITS or BFR is a much larger thing than a Falcon stage. But in terms of the principle of the technology, they've shown they can do it. They've done, once again, something that NASA was making a big snow day over of, oh, how are we ever going to land large payloads on Mars? Well, they're showing you they can land payloads on Mars. Now, I think going straight to the BFR stage of this giant spaceship is probably a bigger leap than I would take anyway on my first go at it. But landing something the size of the Mars Direct vehicles, which is actually comparable to the Falcon stages, I think is a doable thing, and they've shown they can do it.
Let's see who your caller is this time around. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Doug in Southern California. Bob, we've had some recent email exchanges, if you recall. I really do like your Moon Direct concept. I think that it's very similar to sort of the thoughts that I've been having. Let me just comment that it may be that you don't have to actually beam power 36 kilometers. There's right on the rim of Shackleton Crater, there's several about 2 kilometer diameter craters that are probably permanently shrouded as well. This cluster is really right near one of these so-called peaks of eternal light. So it could be that initially you may only need to beam about 1.5 kilometers, something like that.
Well, that makes it that much easier.
Exactly. Question I have is why, in your concept, why not make at least the attempts, whether it's successful or not, but make attempts to use the telerobots to harvest and process the water ice into propellant even prior to crew arrival?
Well, you could do that. I think that there's going to be unexpected difficulties associated with mining lunar ice. And by the way, the microwaves can help you with that, because what you could do is you set up a transparent tent on the ice and you microwave into the tent, and that would vaporize the ice in the tent, and then you could pump the vapor out and condense it in a tank. So you're not picking at it with pickaxes and stuff, because lunar permafrost could be really strong, especially at 40 Kelvin. The idea is that you want to reduce it to practice before you leave it to the robot. But it's in my experience in building various kinds of, for instance, ISRU machines, in-situ resource utilization machines, that we first we operate them manually and then we automate the process once we understand what the issues are. But it's not impossible, what you say. But in any case, you see, if you can land 12 tons on the moon, it means you can land a fully fueled LEV. That is, you can land a cabin the size of the Apollo LEM with a fully fueled hydrogen-oxygen stage under it that can take it all the way from the surface of the moon to LEO and propulsively capture in LEO and have some mass margin to spare.
So your LEV would not aerobrake; it would actually do a full propulsive maneuver?
Yes, that if it takes 3 kilometers a second to ascend from the moon onto trans-Earth injection, and then once you're on trans-Earth injection, which is the same as a TLI orbit, a translunar injection orbit, it takes 3 kilometers a second to capture into LEO. Now, if you wanted to massively expand the mass margin, what you could do is do a 3 kilometer a second burn to go from the moon to trans-Earth injection, and then maybe a 1 kilometer a second burn to capture into a like a GPO-type orbit, then it's an elliptical orbit around the Earth. And then you would do, then you could deploy an enhanced drag device, for instance, a tow balloon or foil or even an electrodynamic tether, and lower your orbit from a GTO orbit into a LEO orbit a couple of passes. But you wouldn't, that's like the kind of aerobraking we do with Mars probe.
Right.
Except we wouldn't do it over 2 months. We would do it over, you know, a week or something. But in other words, we wouldn't be doing high temperature, high G load breaking into Earth orbit or into the Earth's direct entry. We would be doing either a propulsive breaking into Earth orbit, or else propulsive breaking that is into low Earth orbit, or propulsive breaking into an elliptical orbit, and then lower that orbit with a couple of skims over the outermost layers of the exosphere.
Right. Falcon Heavy, it does great up to LEO, but it doesn't have a cryogenic upper stage. How in the world do you get 12 tons to the lunar surface? Because from my calculation...
Well, actually, I don't think that Falcon Heavy really is 60 tons to LEO. It's equivalent. I think Falcon Heavy is designed for GTO delivery of something more like 30 tons. And so once you're on GTO, which is almost translunar injection, then the rest of it is done with the cargo lander using hydrogen-oxygen propulsion.
Right. Okay. Are you familiar with ULA's Zeus concept?
No.
So this is a modified Centaur upper stage to become a lander, and so it has that really excellent, you know, RL-10 efficiency, hydrolux efficiency, and it would be modified to be a lander. So it's just they've had these papers out there, and I think it's a really great idea. You might want to check it out. Also, Anthony Colapri, the primary investigator for the LCROSS mission, he says that the best data from the results indicate that it's not permafrost. You know, it's not hard and solid, but the data seems to indicate that there's these like pure ice crystals within fluffy regolith. That's what the data seems to indicate.
Well, the thing is this. That's one reason why I would want astronauts to do the initial mining, if you will, because we're not quite sure of what we're dealing with. But also I think that if we do, I mean, we'll see. Once we're there, we'll know what the preferred method of mining it is. My own preferred is to use microwaves to vaporize it and condense it in a tank on a trailer, as opposed to shoveling snow or doing pickaxe work on regolith.
Yeah, I do like your idea. It is good. Final question. I mean, you've been, you've testified before Congress and whatnot, working at this over the years. Is there any particular reason to expect the current administration with, you know, the National Space Council and the people involved that they will pick up this idea?
Well, maybe, because, as I say, I'm publishing it in 2 weeks, and they don't have any ideas of their own. No, I mean, I think that they should receive this idea well, because the lunar orbiting space station made no sense. And there are a number of people on that council who do want to return to the moon, and I think that this new architecture makes it possible to do it with a vehicle which, as the previous caller mentioned, is only half as strong as the Saturn V in terms of its lift capability. And the key is, once again, don't deliver the reentry vehicle to the lunar surface or lunar orbit. Keep it in Earth orbit. And even though you've got a big delta V to use on the LEV, it's a very lightweight vehicle. And in other words, even a Dragon weighs 8 tons. The LEV only weighs 2. And so even though you've got twice the mass ratio that you need to go to trans-Earth injection, you've got a much lighter vehicle to do it. And in other words, you could deliver such a vehicle all the way to the surface of the moon. And now you've got direct return from the moon, which, by the way, is how you want to, whether you were doing my architecture or a traditional direct return, that's how you want to do a lunar base. You don't want to do a lunar base with somebody left in lunar orbit for 3 months playing Mike Collins, soaking up cosmic rays and not doing anything useful. I mean, which is sort of what that lunar orbiting space station is. It's a way to house people.
Yeah.
They're not doing anything useful. You want people on the surface of the moon. And then if you're on the surface of the moon, looking up, the Earth is always in the exact same place. So your launch window to Earth is always open. You don't have to do any lunar orbit rendezvous. You can always come straight home whenever you need to. That's a huge advantage. And then also, you have all your personnel on the moon. That's where the science is. That's where the resources are.
How does Moon Direct help with Mars?
Well, first of all, it gets NASA out of its funk of not going anywhere and demoralizing itself with its own impotence, which is really what we're dealing with here. But secondly, we're going to resolve this question of the moon or Mars, the moon or Mars. We're going to do both, okay? And we're going to get started with the moon, and because the gang in there right now, that's what they want to do, and I'm not going to be able to make them change their mind on that. But we can do this while they're in there. Now, furthermore, okay, SpaceX is talking about, this architecture where they refuel the interplanetary transportation system, second stage in Earth orbit in order to send it all the way to the moon, to Mars. Well, if they start a little smaller by simply refueling the Falcon Heavy upper stage in Earth orbit, which is an easier thing to do, because it runs on LOX kerosene, and the kerosene can be easily moved in zero gravity because it's not a cryogen, and liquid oxygen can be moved in zero gravity because it's paramagnetic. You can actually move it with magnets. And so if you can refuel the Falcon Heavy upper stage on orbit, then instead of sending 60 tons to orbit, it can send 60 tons to Mars. And that's enough to do Mars Direct.
Hmm.
In other words,
awesome.
The Falcon Heavy, if they simply introduce that orbital refueling technology on the Falcon Heavy, now all of a sudden you have a vehicle with superior throw capability to a Saturn V, and you can do Mars Direct with that. Now, of course, they're also talking about making a larger launch vehicle, the BFR, which itself would be able to do 150 tons to Earth orbit, which means basically you could use it as a Saturn V and do Mars Direct. But I don't want to wait. I've waited long enough. I was 17 when we landed on the moon, and if anybody had told me I'd be 66 and we wouldn't have a moon base, I would have thought they were crazy. And here we are. I think the American people want a space program that's going somewhere. We got to get going somewhere. And if we don't go somewhere, if the space program, human space flight program, continues to go nowhere, it's eventually going to exhaust the patience of the American people, and it'll be shut down because this is just too much. And we've got the opportunity now. It's been, Musk has thrown NASA a real softball here. We should swing at it and hit it out of the park, because he's given us the capability to immediately have a moon base and to be basically moon base in 4 years, Mars base in 8. That should be the program.
I love it. I really love your lunar architecture, so got my support.
Thank you. And listen, since you're in Southern California, the next Mars Society convention is going to be at the Pasadena Convention Center, August 23rd through 26th, so I hope you can make it.
I'll be there.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
Right,
so listeners, Bob, Doug has freed up that line, and if you want to call us, it's 866-687-7223. Chris is in Mexico and sent in a note and said, in the past you commented on vapor lock, which would make it impractical to place rocket fuel in LEO for a spacecraft to fuel. Chris McKay sort of challenged on that and says it's a done deal and can be done. What is the accurate information about that? And you seem to indicate something about that in your comments with Doug a few minutes ago.
Well, first of all, transfer of cryogens on Earth orbit is not a done deal. It's never been done. Now, that's not to say it can't be done, that there's no way to do it, but transfer of non-cryogens has been done many, many times on Earth orbit, and perhaps that's what Chris is referring to. But the so that's easy. You can do that with elastic bladders. And that's how you would transfer the kerosene into the Falcon Heavy upper stage. Now, in terms of oxygen, the problem you have in zero gravity with a cryogen is you can't move it in bladders. And then if you try to just use an ordinary pump, what happens is you pump away the first bunch of liquid that's right next to the pump, but then the rest of the liquid doesn't go to the pump, and you're stuck. But liquid oxygen is actually attracted by magnets. You could put a magnet next to the pump suction point, and the oxygen would be attracted to it. And so of all the cryogens, liquid oxygen is the easiest one to transfer in zero-G. Now, to my knowledge, no one's ever done it. I'd like to see an experiment showing this. But sure, that could be done. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it is possible, but I'm saying we have to demonstrate the means to do it.
He also said that he really enjoyed your book, Entering Space, Creating a Spacefaring Civilization, and has read it multiple times. And he says that since you wrote this book in 1999, what would you change to update the book for today?
Well, a lot. And in fact, I am working on a new book, and which I hope to have coming out in 2019. It covers some of the same ground that's in Entering Space, but there's a lot that's new in there. To start with, the stuff we're talking about right now, the revolution in space flight that has happened. Because in 1999, these entrepreneurial space companies were still just talk. Now it's for real. We have a real entrepreneurial space race underway, and it's going to make a lot of things cheaper. A lot of these Earth orbital activities, you know, things like space hotels and stuff, which were kind of bullshit in 1999, we're going to have them. Because one thing we're going to get out of these reusable space vehicles is intercontinental travel by rocket, which will go through space to get to the other side of Earth with vehicles that are virtually orbital in velocity. And any such vehicle, well, the first thing you could do would just leave it in orbit for a day, and now you've got an orbital day trip vehicle. And then what the hell, if you want to stay up for more than a day, leave a house on orbit and go there and come back for them later. I mean, but so things like that. But then this Moon Direct architecture is going to be in there, explained at length, and then a revised Mars Direct architecture. Well, there's a lot of stuff on asteroids and interstellar, and of course, you know, the results of the Kepler Space Telescope, and which is just the beginning, because, you know, TESS is going up in a month, and it's going to be 100 times more productive than Kepler. You know, right now we know about 3,000 extrasolar planets. In 1999, I think we knew about four. And by 1919, we're probably going to know about 20,000. By 2019, excuse me. There's a lot that's there. And then I have a very, about a third of the book is discussing why we need to do this. And some of the stuff is the kind of stuff that people have talked about, which is science, except a lot more to talk about there, and, you know, averting asteroidal impacts and so forth. But then I'm also going to talk about the significance of human expansion into space for the prospect of peace and freedom on Earth. And because how we conceive of the future will how we conceive of the far future is going to determine the near future, because ideas have consequences.
You have another caller on the line. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, he mentioned, Dr. Zubrin mentioned nuclear power. Has he heard of the Kilopower project NASA's been working on for the last couple of years?
Yeah, I have, and it sounds very promising. Where do you stand with that?
Oh, I'm all for it. I mean, I looked at the design. It's a completely compact system. In fact, I hope they can do the same thing with probably larger scale nuclear power. Make just completely make systems that are everything's just kind of inside of the is packed together. That way, you can mass produce them and send them out. Send them out across the country.
Well, it's very promising, and I hope they, take it beyond the concept stage and build flight units. First they'll build working, ground test units and then flight units. But this is something that, frankly, NASA should have done half a century ago. I hope that this time they'll follow through.
I agree, absolutely. Right now, in Huntsville, they're actually working on a fusion powered rocket, and even the person working on it, Dr. Casper, even said that you'd have to have nuclear fission anyway, at least to power to get it fired up, kind of like the battery for an automobile engine. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Hello, I'm right here.
Yeah, anything else, Tim?
That's it.
Okay, I appreciate your call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wrong line. Bob, you put a paper out about a month ago about mistakes in the Drake equation, which I found interesting. I've actually got several advance emails from listeners wanting to ask you about that. Can you tell us a little bit about where you see mistakes in the Drake equation? I'm sure all of our listeners are very familiar with it, so we're beyond the basic introduction part of it. But I've read your paper in Centauri Dreams, but tell us about it.
Well, the problem with the Drake equation is that it makes two implicit assumptions. One is that intelligent life will only arise once in a solar system, and secondly, that it can never spread from solar system to solar system. Now, Drake did not include the idea that civilizations would develop interstellar travel and could spread from one point to another. So there's no term in the Drake equation that refers to that, but also the other thing's a little bit more subtle. If you look at the Drake equation and examine it in detail, because he talks about the rate of star formation in the galaxy, and then he multiplies that by various fractions. Okay, which stars have planets? Which planets are any good? Which good planets develop microbial life, which microbial planets develop advanced life, which advanced life develops technological civilization, and so forth. Okay, and then there's L, which is how long that civilization lasts. So what you're basically saying is that if you have a planet that takes 4 billion years to develop, and it develops a civilization, and that civilization lasts And a civilization for Drake means a civilization that has radio, okay? Because it doesn't count. You're not transmitting if you're in the Bronze Age, okay? So if this civilization, which is at the technological level of radio, which is to say the technological level of World War II or better, only lasts 1,000 years, then only for 1,000 years out of the 4 billion years of the lifetime of that civilization, of that planet, will it be transmitted? and that's an infinitesimal fraction of time. Okay? Now, but consider the following. If we had a nuclear war, civilization would be up and running again within a century or two. Okay? And like it never happened. If we had an asteroid hit the Earth and it wiped out humanity, but it left a substantial fraction of the biosphere intact, like, say, the KT event did. A few million years after the KT event, the biosphere was booming again with a new selection of mammals and birds and the different large reptiles than the dinosaurs. But, you know, we are back in business. It did it. Now, 4 million years is only 1/1000th the time of 4 billion years. And 400 years is a tiny fraction of the 4 billion years. So what the Drake equation leaves out is this concept that once a planet has developed a biosphere, its regeneration time after a disaster is much quicker than the time it took to evolve intelligence starting from chemistry. Okay? And it's faster by fractions of thousands, millions of times faster. And so this is a huge error in the Drake equation. And some people, like at the SETI Institute, commented, "Oh, you're just using a different number for L." No, that's not what I'm saying. Okay, what I'm saying is that the equation itself is wrong. It's not a question of choosing an alternate value for L. It's a question that there's terms missing from the equation.
Okay, and they, of course, don't buy that, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they just don't, the person I was talking to didn't quite understand that. But the equation is wrong. It's like, leaving something out of an equation, not just choosing a different value for one of the terms.
So how do you have a conclusion for the Drake equation when you are you able to correct it? Let me put it that way.
Yeah, I put out a substitute equation, and basically if you take the simplest way to look at it is this: is if you divide the number. Okay, if n is the number of civilizations. And B is the number of stars that have advanced biospheres. By an advanced biosphere, I mean the kind of thing that's existed on the Earth for the past several hundred million years with a multitude of multicellular species inhabiting land and oceans and so forth. Okay? The number of civilizations divided by the number of biospheres equals L divided by the regeneration time. Okay, and the difference there is if you were to put this in the same terms as the Drake equation, instead of the regeneration time, he would have the lifetime of the solar system. So in that term there, where I would have at most a few million years, he's got billions of years. So right there, you've got thousands of times more civilizations than the Drake equation would lead you to. And then the question of civilization spreading. We've had radio, call it 100 years if you like to have radio that's any good. The 50 years after we had radio, we had nuclear power, and space travel. So the time between a civilization that has radio and a civilization with nuclear power and space travel is less than a century, and in other words, it's the blink of an eye. And then what is the time between when you have nuclear power and space travel to when you have interstellar travel? Well, we don't know because we haven't achieved interstellar travel yet. But I would suspect that we're at most, I think we could be as little as 50 years away from interstellar travel or as most, say, a couple of centuries. But still, once again, a very short amount of time compared to the life of the planet or even the human species. So once you have a civilization, I think shortly after that, you're going to have interstellar travel capabilities. Now, the pessimistic counter to that, which was very much on people's minds in 1961, is that once you have advanced technology, you might destroy yourself with a nuclear war. Okay? Because, you know, you have radio and nuclear power, you probably have nuclear bombs. And of course, in 1961, people were expecting that to happen pretty soon. And I think that's part of the whole business with the L in that equation at that time. But if we had a nuclear war, once again, it wouldn't be the end of the biosphere, and it probably wouldn't even be the end of human civilization. It would be obviously a disaster. It'd be a major setback. But the Earth would not be set back 4 billion years. It might be set back 40 years or 400 years. You know, or if humanity drove itself into extinction, it might be set back 4 million years. But not 4 billion years.
Bjorn in Sweden says all life on Earth has one and the same origin. This is pretty much the scientific consensus for many good reasons. So if star-flying life is common, why have they never, or only once, 4 billion years ago, landed on Earth? Doesn't our evolutionary secludedness prove that we are very alone in our category?
No, because, first of all, it's undemonstrated that interstellar microbes only landed once on Earth. Well, first of all, it's not demonstrated that they have landed on Earth, but if you adopt the hypothesis that life on Earth was seeded from interstellar space, it could have been seeded many times, and additional genes could have been inserted into our solar system by interstellar microbes. I wrote a paper on this, too, called Interstellar Communication Using Microbes, which suggests that the most effective form of interstellar communication is to send microbes, because the purpose of interstellar communication could very well be propaganda, i.e. propagation. And you want to spread your own kind, and you could do that by spreading various kinds of microbes, both to initiate life on other worlds and perhaps to put the kind of life on other worlds that would tend to evolve into our kind of life.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, Dr. Spaeth and Dr. Zubrin. This is David calling from the Seattle area.
Okay.
Hello.
Very exciting, your plans. I am feeling kind of pessimistic about the ability to make it happen because of the huge political momentum in our government behind the SLS and Alliance. What are your thoughts about overcoming that momentum and keeping the SLS and Orion guys from squelching this kind of plan?
Well, first of all, I think that if we had an actual plan to return to the moon or go to Mars or both, that to the extent that SLS or Orion can have a rationale, it would reinforce it. In other words, to take SLS, the biggest problem with SLS, other than the fact that they've been working on it for 15 years and haven't flown it yet, is that it doesn't have a mission. So it'd be like in the 60s, us building Saturn V without building the rest of the moon program hardware. So you have this big rocket with nothing for it to launch. And that is the most absurd aspect of the SLS. So for the SLS, the best possible thing that could happen is for there to be a Moon-Mars program. The SLS has one advantage over the Falcon Heavy, which is that it does have a larger payload. It is much more expensive, but it has a larger payload. And if there were missions that needed that larger payload, you could say, there you are. We have the SLS. The Orion, there are certain missions in which Orion could be advantageous. But once again, you know, it's over-designed for transporting crew to space stations. It's under-designed for missions to Mars as a habitat. And as a reentry capsule, it's too big. For missions to, you know, near-Earth heliocentric space, or, I mean, frankly, I think this is why they came up with the Deep Space Gateway, because Orion is about perfect for riding out to lunar orbit and back. And so they wanted to have some place to go. But once again, the real problem with these things is that they're being built in isolation from any program that can use them. And so they're left with constructing meaningless programs for the purpose of using them. So we're not spending money to do things. We're doing things in order to spend money. And this is the real problem you have. So we need a purpose-driven space program. We have a purpose-driven space astronomy program. We have a purpose-driven robotic space exploration program. We need a purpose-driven human spaceflight program. And if we had it, then and only then could these other things find a purpose.
David, are you there?
Yeah, I have a follow-up question. This is a little off on a tangent, but it was inspired by your discussion of the Drake equation. We're pretty certain that there were at least two other, perhaps three other versions of genus Homo that coexisted with Homo sapien on this planet. Why do you suppose that those other versions that had the same size brains that we have, obviously probably as intelligent as we are, maybe more so, didn't survive in different areas or different continents and arise their own civilization in competition with our own?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. The most convincing book I've read on that is a book called Neanderthal Enigma, which addresses this very question. Neanderthal coexisted with Homo sapiens, and individual Neanderthals are more physically formidable than our kind of people, and their brains were just as big. But there's significant evidence that they didn't have language, and that would certainly make the difference. If they couldn't talk to each other, in the sense that we can, exchanging complex ideas. You know, if you have language, you can take a technology and turn it into words, even without written language, just spoken language. All of a sudden, all sorts of things, from technologies to military plans to, you know, histories, can be turned into strings of words, and you become much more effective.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. So, listeners, there's still time if you want to get a call in, 866-687-7223. Several emails are awaiting for you, Bob. So this is from Jorge Perez in Florida, Miami, Florida. What skills should I acquire or practice to be one of the first 1,000 people on Mars?
Well, that's interesting. You know, the kinds of people that will be most useful on Mars, well, on the first mission to Mars, you need flight engineers and field scientists like geologists. If we're talking about the early Mars base, you still need those kinds of people, but you need mechanical engineers and you need agronomists, greenhouse farmers. An early Mars colony, you need those kinds of people, but you'll also need teachers and, you know, construction workers and all sorts of people like that. You'll meet doctors and nurses and, hopefully we'll be able to hold off on lawyers for a while.
Okay, and let's see. You've got another guy on hold, but I'm going to do the emails first. Doug says, what if intelligent civilizations routinely create desktop chemical factories that could be used to accidentally produce self-replicating chemicals that consume atmospheric CO2 completion? How far would that set back life? Jesus Christ. Okay.
Well, we have systems that consume atmospheric CO2. They're called plants, and they're very important for the biosphere.
Well, they don't set life back. They encourage life and help life, right?
That's right. I'm for plants, yeah.
And I've got a couple of desktop plants, Doug. So I don't know. So you don't really have a response to him for that?
Well, things that consume CO2 are essential for the biosphere, and they're called plants. And they bring CO2 levels down to manageable amounts by consuming it and turning it into carbohydrates and other things that are useful for life.
Tim sent in an email after his phone call. Could the Falcon Heavy launch with a space probe to Jupiter on a direct trajectory if it had a third stage booster or extended the fuel tank and a really cool paint job?
I don't know about the paint job, but
I mean,
sure.
I don't know what to say. I mean,
the Falcon Heavy could certainly be used to launch payloads directly to Jupiter because it's got, especially with if you put a cryogenic upper stage on it.
Is there any chance that NASA would adopt a Falcon Heavy for a NASA mission?
Yes. There's a very good chance. They're using a Falcon 9 for a very important NASA mission coming up, which is TESS. And this, by the way, is going to be a critical test for SpaceX because up till now, these Falcons have launched things, resupply missions to the space station. If one of those was launched, lost, it's not like the whole world would start, screaming. There's been some other satellites they've lost that have caused more heartburn. But losing TESS would be a huge setback for SpaceX. On the other hand, if they succeed in launching TESS, which, by the way, is going into heliocentric space, then they've played a critical role in a major mission, a mission that promises to be as historic as Kepler, and they've all of a sudden gotten themselves into the space astronomy and space science world in a very serious way.
Okay, and another caller is waiting. And hi, caller, who are you? Where are you, please?
Oh, this is just Marshall again. Okay. I promise to be quick.
Go ahead.
You were talking about the Drake equation, and one of the faults of the Drake equation that always bugged me is he assumed that no species ever really becomes spacefaring and goes out and literally populates the whole galaxy. And I once calculated that if you could get nuclear fusion, helium-3 type tokamak fusion, you probably could get 5% of the speed of light, which means in a billion years we could populate the whole galaxy. What do you see wrong with that idea?
Well, I don't think anything's wrong. I think there's a bunch of assumptions there. Because first of all, would a species maintain its nature and its purpose over that period of time? Because there's evolution. I believe interstellar travel is ultimately possible. I think that fusion might be the way that we do it. I don't think we do it with tokamak because they are a closed system, but with an open-ended system like a field reverse configuration, it could probably create a fusion rocket. And yes, 5% speed of light is about what it might be able to do. On the other hand, one might try to colonize the galaxy by spreading seeds, not by sending out expeditions. That's, if you want to see my ideas on that, I wrote a paper called Interstellar Communication Using Microbes. It's on Venturi Dreams, and you can Google it and find it.
Yeah. I kind of agree with you. As soon as we really become a spacefaring species, we are a different species. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Marshall. Bob, Breakthrough, Dr. Lubin, and others want to use light propulsion and beam to maybe 20-25% the speed of light with their wafer type of programs, you know, with swarms and swarms of thousands of wafers to Proxima B. Your thoughts on that type of laser beam propulsion down the road?
Well, yeah, you could do that, and that might be a way to send the seeds. In other words, in my paper, I talk about microsail craft, which are basically tiny solar sail spacecraft, maybe with a sail 10 or 15 microns in diameter, 1 micron thick, carrying a little capsule of a sphere, maybe 4 or 6 microns in diameter. And sunlight could push those out of our solar system at speeds of like 30 kilometers a second. But if you used lasers to push them, we could get them going much, much faster. Cut the travel time to the nearby stars for them by a factor of 10 or more. And so, sure.
Two more quick emails are here for you. Alec says that in 2003, Michael Crichton gave a speech in which he said the only way to work the Drake equation is to fill it in with guesses, which are, in fact, just expressions of prejudice. He said there are no such things as informed guesses. SETI is not a science. SETI is a religion. Do you have any thoughts on Michael Crichton's comments?
Well, I don't think he's right. We have been filling in terms of the Drake equation. The Kepler Space Telescope has just proven that planets around stars are probably more the rule than the exception. So that term in the Drake equation, at the number of planets that there are around, you know, the number of stars that have planets is better than 50%, we've now proven to be true. So there's a lot that we can fill in on the Drake equation. And as far as SETI being a religion, that's an interesting formulation. Science is a faith. Science is a faith that the universe makes sense. Science is a faith that there are laws of the universe that the human mind is capable of eliciting, that and that the rationality of those laws is something that would appear rational to the human mind and therefore can be discovered as a rational law of nature. This is what, I mean, Kepler said this. He said, instructing his search for laws of planetary motion. Geometry is one of the eternal, one and eternal, a reflection out of the mind of God that mankind shares in it is one reason to call man the image of God. So in other words, that if that which created the universe is proceeding through a form of rationality that is the same as what a human mind would perceive as being rational, then those laws can be perceived by the human mind. And in other words, that the universe can appear to make sense because it's what a human mind would regard as making sense. This is the fundamental conceit behind science, that the universe makes sense. And if we look hard enough and think hard enough, and we can find out what the laws are, that there are laws there to be sense. That is the faith underlying science. Now, the faith underlying SETI is very close to that, which is, as above, so below, that the laws of the universe, as they manifested themselves on Earth, would manifest themselves similarly elsewhere in the universe, and that, therefore, if the laws of science are such as would lead to the development of life and chemistry on Earth, they would do so elsewhere. Okay? That's what the SETI hypothesis is, and it's very close to the fundamental hypothesis of science, which is that the universe is lawful, okay, not random, And Einstein said it, God doesn't play with dice. And if intelligence and life could evolve here, it could evolve elsewhere. And the fact that life appeared on Earth virtually immediately after it could, in other words, we have fossils of life on Earth, confirmed fossils going back 3.5 billion years ago, strongly supported fossils going back 3.8 billion years ago, which is right to the end of the heavy bombardment of Earth. So in other words, life appeared on Earth immediately after it could. That says that, you know, it is a logical development, that life evolves from chemistry in the same way that ice evolves from water when the temperature is cold enough. Okay? It's not hit or miss. It happens when you have the appropriate physical conditions. That's the hypothesis behind SETI. And so that's why I think that SETI is very much a scientific endeavor. It is based on the same faith that science is based on.
David sent in an email. Do you know what happened to the Zuma mission?
Refresh. Oh, that was this mission that failed.
Yeah, well, right, that launched on SpaceX.
Right.
The top secret mission.
I don't have any inside information as to whose fault that was.
No. Should we have asked you about something that we haven't talked about yet, anything I've forgotten or the listeners have forgotten to bring to your attention?
Well, I just want to tell people about a couple of upcoming events.
Okay.
Number one, we're going to have the University Rover Challenge in the desert near Hanksville, Utah, May 31st through June 2nd. And if any of the listeners are journalists, I would encourage you to come and cover it. Otherwise, you can come and see it. And then we're going to have the Mars Society Convention in Pasadena, California, August 23rd through 26th. We have the call for papers out now. If you have an idea relating to Mars exploration, anything from near-term robotic missions through human missions through the terraforming of Mars, technical, social, send in your abstract. We've got the call for papers. Go to MarsSociety.org, and you can see how to do it.
So I want to ask you something before we sign off, because a listener sent me the YouTube video of your talk in Abu Dhabi last year, and I was watching it actually while I was eating dinner. It's a great way to eat dinner. And your comments on scarcity and global harmony and global peace through space, I found really compelling. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Look, the basic point is this. Ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have bad consequences. And the worst idea that there has ever been is that there is only so much to go around. This is the idea that fundamentally drove the catastrophes of the 20th century, World War I, World War II, the Holocaust. You know, you have Hitler saying, Germany needs living space. We have to go out and exterminate people to appropriate their living space. Okay, this is all pure nonsense. Germany today is smaller than the Third Reich. It has a larger population and a far higher standard of living. They never needed living space. It was all in their mind. Because there's no such thing as natural resources. There's only natural raw materials. It's human creativity that is the resource. It is people that create wealth. Land does not create wealth. Okay. The farmers, of course, create wealth out of the land, and the farmers are productive in proportion to their technology. And that's what creates wealth. And here's the thing. If people believe that there's only so much to go around, and I happen to know, I mean, I've met them. There are people in the Pentagon right now, even at this hour of the night, who are making contingency plans for wars with China and things like this based on the ultimate hypothesis that the 21st century is going to be one of resource wars, that we have to keep China down because if they get a standard of living like ours, they're going to use up all the oil and there won't be any for us, and so forth. And you can bet your bottom dollar there are people exactly like them in Beijing and in Moscow who are thinking the same thing about us. Okay? Exactly the same thing. And this was exactly what people were thinking about in the German general staff in 1914. And if you have this mindset, then you're in a pre-war situation, fundamentally. But it's a lie, okay? It is not a problem for China that Americans are 4% of the world's population and we're using 25% of the world's oil, okay? It's a great thing for China that we use this much oil because that's why our 4% of the world's population makes 50% of the world's inventions. And it's those inventions that are allowing China to rapidly advance its standard of living. The other 50% are made by the rest of the West. Okay? And it's not a problem for us that China is developing, not fundamentally, because if the sons and daughters of Chinese peasants become scientists and engineers, China will start contributing to technological progress on a per capita basis comparable to that of the Western nations, and human progress as a whole will advance much faster. So, you know, national social Darwinism is a completely false idea. In fact, human beings create resources. And in fact, the truth about humanity is that we are not nations competing for a share of a fixed pie, but that we are different parts of a common human race who are cooperatively, an odd way, but nevertheless fundamentally cooperatively, because any invention anywhere ultimately becomes available to everyone everywhere, expanding the resources, expanding the prospects of the human race. But people have to see that, because if they don't understand that, then we're going to war. And the greatest proof we could have of the falsity of this limited resource view is if we open up new worlds to humanity. That will make it tangible that you can see that worlds that were previously nothing, that were deserts, where no one could even go, have become new worlds, new places for human beings to live, new branches of human civilization to be born, that this is what we can do, that the future is not Soylent Green, it's Star Trek. And we have to make that future visible. That is how we're going to prevent the 21st century from following the catastrophes of the 20th.
And we do that through space.
That's right.
And how do you get these generals and people in the Pentagon and even people in NASA and elsewhere, academia, to see this? Because that the implementation or the belief in this is crucial.
Once again, the problem is not those generals. The problem is the zeitgeist, the ideas that are held by the population as a whole, at large. You know, 1972, this group of elitists called the Club of Rome published a document called The Limits to Growth,
right,
in which they made predictions that the world was going to run out of everything by about the year 2000. And run out of oil, copper, zinc, were going to run out because this is how much the reserves were and this is how much we were using every year. And if you divide the reserves by the amount we're using every year, then it runs out in 25 years or 30 years or something like that. Okay. Well, none of it happened. None of it happened. In fact, all of these resources are more plentiful today, that is, there's more reserves of them known today than were known in 1972. But guess what? A couple of years ago, the Club of Rome published another book, and they said, Limits to Growth Revisited. And here's what they said. They said, well, I guess our predictions didn't actually happen, but they were fundamentally right. They must be right. Because even though these oil reserves over here were discovered and this new way of mining copper was discovered and yada, 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 these were just delayed the inevitable because fundamentally there is only so much resources on the planet Earth, okay? And in other words, they just, despite the fact that their predictions were counterfactual, they said they must be fundamentally right based on the axiom that there is only so much here, okay? Now, we have to prove that here is not all there is. That the Earth has, you know, yeah, there's 6,000 kilometers above us and there's an infinite sky above us.
So that seems like a really big undertaking.
Well, it is. It's the real war. It's the war of ideas. It's the way we understand things. It's the way we understand the future. And this idea that human beings are fundamentally allies, that we are fundamentally brothers and sisters, this idea has had its ups and downs. Okay? You know, we had the first half of the 20th century, two gigantic catastrophes and many smaller catastrophes in between them, all because of that other idea. Then, in 1945, a bunch of smart men got together and they said, how do we prevent this from happening again? And they said, well, we need two things. We need collective security and we need free trade. Okay, because free trade benefits all nations, and it's the stopping of free trade, the trade war of the 1930s that set off the Great Depression that drove people and nations crazy and set off World War II. Okay, and because those ideas were so successful that since 1945 we haven't had another general war and we haven't had another depression, and in this country, for example, no serious politician has run for president of either party who contested those ideas until 2016. And now you have, just a month ago, Steve Bannon went off and he gave a speech in which he said, you know, 20 years from now, the question everyone is going to ask is, what did you do to stop the rise of China? Okay? And so forth. This idea that nativism is just the flip side of green ecologism. They're both saying there isn't enough to go around. The one says there isn't enough resources to go around. The other says there aren't enough opportunities to go around. Okay? And so human aspirations must be suppressed. These ideas have to be defeated. And they have to be defeated. The proof that will defeat them is technological progress and human expansion into space. And so when we go to space, we're not just doing something fun, hey, let's go to Mars. We are showing that the ultimate resource is human creativity, that human beings are good things, and that human beings, the human race, are brothers and sisters in a common enterprise to expand the human prospect.
Well, we need to be able to sell that idea, and it is a challenge. But, I mean,
we sell the idea by proving the idea.
Right.
That's the idea.
But we're not in space yet, so to speak, so we have to pre-prove the idea, I guess, right?
We will prove it by doing it.
Prove it by doing it. Okay, listen, when I heard you on YouTube on the Abu Dhabi video that I watched, it was really an eye-opening couple of minutes listening to that, and it has been the same on the space show, and I hope people will pay attention to it. And listeners, you can find it real easily on YouTube if you want to hear it and watch Bob at the same time. Bob, I want to really thank you for being with us and staying a little bit late, and we appreciate hearing from you, and I look forward to seeing you and talking to you again down the road.
All right. Hope I'll see you in Pasadena.
You know, I may be able to pull it off this year. I'd really like to, and my son is nearby in Hollywood, and I have a lot of reasons to be down there near him this year. So, you know, we'll see if we can make it happen, and I look forward to it. Thanks a lot, and I'll send you the archive recording when I get it done, probably early in the morning.
All right.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it, and Hotel Mars tomorrow, Friday, Space Show, Sunday Space Show, open lines. Don't miss all of it. Thanks to Bob Zubrin for being with us, all of you who called and emailed. And everybody have a great rest of the week. Good night, everyone.